Today's episode of Rapid's Podcast is sponsored by Audible. It's summer, and that's the perfect time for audiobooks. Whether it's a mystery, thriller, memoir, or bestseller, Audible is there to turn any time into story time. Just download your books or shows to your mobile device and listen anytime, anywhere. I've been an Audible customer for a couple of years now, and I love having the ability to listen to anything that I might read as an audiobook. With an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news and comedy, Audible is the best source for summertime entertainment. The Audible app makes listening a breeze with features like chapter navigation and the narration speed control. Really works great. You can even share your favorite audio excerpts with friends. You can access your books and shows anytime, anywhere, right from your smartphone or tablet. Are you listening to anything good on Audible? Lately, I have been listening to the Ask Gary V book. Gary Vaynerchuk is one of my favorites. He did a really good job of pulling a bunch of interesting questions from his Ask Gary V podcast, and they're all there in one book. I always want to hear what you guys are reading as well. Let me know. We got a new hashtag where we can share suggestions for Audible. Use hashtag Audible RHAP to let me know what you're listening to. I'll do the same. Join Audible today and explore the world's leading provider of audiobooks, all beautifully performed by talented actors and narrators. So start a 30-day trial and download your first audiobook for free. That's audible.com/RHAP for a free 30-day trial and audiobook. Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cesternino back here for another one of our Survivor off-season series of podcasts, and we've got a great one here today because joining me back in the studio is one of the great friends of Rob as a podcast, somebody who we've talked to before about the Survivor challenges and the genius. Here he is to talk about some emergent strategies in the Survivor challenges, aka hacking the challenges. Please welcome Miles Nye.
Hello. Hey, everybody.
How you doing, Miles?
I'm doing terrific. I'm so pumped to be here.
I'm so excited to have you back here on the show when we sort of like laid out, okay, what are we going to do this summer in terms of the off-season podcast? We didn't know what, but we said, okay, well, we'll do something with Miles. And so we're glad we were able to figure out a reason to have you back on to talk about something.
Well, there's no limit to how much I want to talk about the minutia and the micronesia of every aspect.
The micronesia,
The micronesia minutia, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, good to have you back. Of course, for people who may have come to the podcast in the last year or so since the last time we talked to you, could you give us a little bit more about your background and your relationship with Survivor?
Yeah, I'm a full-time game designer. I own a business here in LA called Wise Guys Events. We create playful experiences for professionals and all kinds of events where people are playing games. And as a result, that work led me in 2007. I sent a cold call email to John Kerhofer, saying that I wanted to sort of discuss challenge ideas with him. And then he gave me the opportunity to interview as a challenge consultant. And I came in the room and pitched some ideas for different games. I've worked on a consulting basis, helping conceive notions for potential challenges on future seasons. Almost every year since, I realized like I've actually consulted on more seasons of Survivor than not, which is crazy because my background is just as a fan of the show, and then the opportunity to, in some small way, influence more seasons than not. It's really cool.
Yeah, I think I'm at this point where I have podcasts more seasons of Survivor than not, if you include my time at the Fishbowl, from Vanuatu through Cook Islands, I think I've done. So I'm not sure exactly the math, but I think we're pretty close.
But then there's TEOS, so you've podcasted every season of Survivor wall to wall.
Sure.
And the number of hours you've spent talking about Survivor dwarfs the number of hours of Survivor that have broadcast.
Yeah, I think I definitely have that record of the person with the most recorded hours of talking about this show at this point. I don't know who's tracking it, but I think that they'll put that on my resume somewhere.
Gold star.
Where if I want to make sure I never get another job again, I'll make sure to have that on the resume. But Miles, and you are also a member of, what is it, the National Association of Puzzlers?
Oh yeah, the National Puzzlers League.
Yes.
Why are you snickering? That's not nerdy at all. That's a cool thing.
It's a great title.
The National Puzzlers League is the oldest puzzle club in America, and so I joined that a few years ago. And this year, I attended the Puzzle Con for the first time ever. I went to Salt Lake City, and it's an annual event, and I've been meaning to go for years, and I finally attended. And it was a blast. It was hosted by Will Shortz, whom a lot of people know. He's the editor of the New York Times Crossword Puzzle, and he's on NPR every week. He's a big wig in the Puzzle League. But there was also a fellow there... This is a little embarrassing. So in the at the Puzzlers League, there's a few conventions. Nobody uses their real names there.
Really?
You have a nom de puzzle.
Okay.
And so there's a guy there. I only know his name as Wombat. I probably know... he probably told me his real name at one time, but I forgot because it wasn't as memorable as Wombat.
What is the reason for the anonymity?
Oh, that's a good question. It's an old-fashioned club. It's actually older than crossword puzzles. Like, when crossword puzzles came out, apparently, the members of the National Puzzlers League were like, what is this fad? This will blow over. This is beneath us.
Do you have to wear a mask like the Riddler?
You don't have to.
But some people
do. Well, it's less like the Riddler and more like Eyes Wide Shut. No, that's not true. Nobody wears a mask. It's a convention of the club. It's like a nom de puzzle. And usually your nom that you choose is some kind of puzzly interpretation of your real name in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. So like people's noms might be an anagram of their name. But Wombat is... Neil Gottlieb's brother. He's not one of the twins.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So, and you know, Neil himself was very strong in the puzzle parts of Survivor. That was among his many positive attributes. So I got to spend a lot of quality time with Neil's brother, whose name
Wombat.
Yeah.
And what's your, can you reveal your name?
Of course. No, it's not a secret.
Kilometer.
That's clever. it's Owler.
Owler.
Owler is an isotext of my name. And isotext means if you punch in the letters on a telephone dial for my name, M-Y-L-E-S, the same numbers on the telephone dial will give you O-W-L-E-R. It's like an autocorrect kind of.
Yeah. It's like an escape the room premise.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Well, you know, I, Miles, too, am a member of the National Bum Puzzle Association.
I'm completely bum puzzled right now.
Yeah. They administer an admissions test, and if you fail it, then you get into the club.
Yes. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what we're here to get into today, this idea of hacking the Survivor challenges. So let's just set up what we're going to be looking at.
Well, I think this is an idea that originated with the great Angie Kontz. She was the one who suggested this might be like a fruitful opportunity for
really,
a conversation.
Really, the point person on the Survivor summer off-season series of podcasts.
It would be a lonely, quiet summer without Angie's contribution.
Yes.
So full tip of the hat to Angie.
Yes.
And she said, well, what about this opportunity to discuss challenges that have come up in the past and that might come up in the future? Almost thinking of it as like coaching a fictional future survivor. Hey, if you see these repeat challenges come up again, how might you approach them? And also to discuss how people have played them or hacked them in the past and exploring the notion of emergent gameplay. Emergent gameplay is an expression that's used in game design where complex solutions can arise from simple gameplay mechanics. There's the opportunity for creative solutions, maybe even solutions that the designers didn't intend. That's emergent gameplay. On a macro version, Richard's Alliance on season one of Survivor, classic emergent gameplay. Nobody said, hey, get a group of people, agree ahead of time on whom you're going to vote for every time, and you can win the game. That was, you know, some would say Richard's great brainstorm that impacted the game. But on a micro, on a challenge by challenge level, you often see emergent gameplay. Some great examples are, and, you know, I went back and rewatched some challenges. I read some Survivor Wiki, hat tip to Survivor Wiki.
And Andrew Savage.
And Andrew Savage. I believe he's the lead editor on Survivor Wiki.
Yeah.
He's there every morning updating, you know, taking down misinformation and making sure that everything's proofread and correct. reading on challenges and how people have played them. But so the example that I think that springs to mind would be, I believe that Penner was the first person to do this. Malcolm did this as well.
Yes.
Penner, tell us, you ran over to the sand pit where all the bags for your tribe were buried, and you dug them all up so that your tribe mates would be able to find them easily when they ran to the sand pit. Does that ring a bell?
Yes. So did Penner do this in Philippines and then Malcolm tried the same strategy in Karamoan the following season?
I'm pretty sure it's correct. It's kind of the hallmark of a repeat survivor, like somebody who knows that they're not going to get yelled at for doing something like that. And if you think of a workaround that doesn't explicitly break the rules of the challenge, I think it was Penner in Philippines and Malcolm in Karamoan. But if we're wrong, they'll let us know in the comments, I'm sure.
They'll let us know. Yeah, the idea is that there was sort of like a sand pit that had a bunch of puzzle pieces tied up and you had to get through and pull them all. You're supposed to, like, each person was supposed to go, and I think that Penner had the idea, what if I just take them all out and then they're all out and then you can get them? And then I think that Malcolm then tried it, but I feel like it didn't work when Malcolm did it.
You still had to, like, then win a skee ball challenge or something.
Yeah.
So it was a good idea. Or the other example might be, okay, this is the United We Stand challenge, which Parvati played first in Cook yes. Island's one.
Cook's Island one.
And yep. then she played it in Fans versus Favorites. You were supposed to use these tall poles with small pedestals at the top of them. The idea was you were supposed to use them like lily pads, and you would have somebody step onto one, and the whole tribe is holding the bottom of them. This challenge got played most recently in the season we just saw.
In Koh Rong.
But then, again, Parvati, once she was a return player and was like, oh, you know, I can bring more creative solutions, they just used it like a tray to just carry her
like
from
chariot,
one side to
yeah.
the Yeah, like a chair, like a tall, skinny chariot. So there was... when you've got James on your tribe who's got the strength to hold that thing from the bottom, it's a good idea. And then my understanding is when they did it in Koh Rong, they were like, you may know that previous survivors did this. Yeah, we're not allowing that this time. So it's, you know, this is the opportunity for both the contestants and production to sort of evolve along with each other and you know, design or devise these emergent strategies. But that kind of thing, like digging up all the sandbags or... there was an underwater challenge where there was a bunch of coconuts in a long cage, and Ozzy, because he can hold his breath for so long, he moved all the coconuts for his tribe close to the entrance to the cage so that his fellow tribe mates would be able to get them easier. That's the kind of thing we're going to talk about. Okay. What are strategies that you might use or, yeah.
And so these are challenges that have already been hacked. You're not coming in and saying, this is what people should do. This is what we have already seen different survivors have played and have figured out in recurring challenges.
I have a mix. Okay. I have index cards here with challenges on them. And also, we got a lot of great input from the patrons as well. And in the Rob has a patron group on Facebook.
Okay.
People who suggested challenges. Some of these, I'm going to say, here's strategies that people have used in the past. And some of these are questions that the patrons asked, hey, if you were facing this challenge, how might you hack it? And many of them, I have no idea. And I feel like we put our heads together and who knows, we might help some, we might be a good coach to a future survivor.
Yes. Not like Coach Wade.
Well, I wouldn't be so sure about that, Rob.
Yeah. I've hacked many games. I've hacked a game of soccer. I've hacked symphonies, hacked computers. I've hacked into the DNC. No.
That was you?
That was Coach.
You shouldn't have done that, Coach. That's yeah. yeah. A lot of people were upset about that, Coach.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go. Where do you want to start?
Well, let's start the great Jeff Quest.
Yes.
Which is a great name as well. I think he's up there with Colin Stone as far as the like robust
yes,
names.
Yes, born identity type names.
So yeah. Jeff Quest brought up this repeat challenge often called Hot Pursuit.
Yes.
And this is a challenge that premiered in Survivor Palau. The whole tribe is chained to each other. Every person has a bag with weight on it. At any time, you can unclip, but you got to give your weight to somebody else. And you're chasing the other tribe on a circular course. And the object of the game is to catch the other tribe and touch them. Or in some instances, you've got to pull one of their members to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I love this challenge. This is one of my all-time favorite challenges. And it's been repeated multiple times. In Gabon, they played it not in the water, but on the ground. And they were carrying a big, heavy snake. It was called Snake in the Grass.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I love about the water version of this challenge is that the tide is a factor. Because as time goes by and the tide rises, it's easier to walk through ankle-deep water than it is to make your way through waist-deep water. So there's a natural raising of the stakes. And it's a dandy challenge. I really like it. And different tribes have attempted different challenges. And so this is an open question. What is a good way to approach the strategy of this challenge?
And the other part of this is that people can check out at any point and you can leave, but you have to hand off your weight to somebody else. And I feel like that the idea that comes up, and I feel like that the last time this was run back in Karamoan, this was post-swap in Karamoan, and famously Corinne and Philip battled about this. And Corinne said, I know what to do. We played this in Gabon. And Philip said, no, I have to do this. And he was just insisting they go slow. Philip felt like slow and steady wins the race here, which is definitely not the emergent strategy.
It is
on
not
this one.
The optimal strategy in any way. It's a race.
So the question is, I think with this one is, are you better off just from the jump, take your weakest people, just get them out of there, give all the weight to your strongest people, and have them do some mad dash to catch the other team?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, it's interesting. Like, it kind of boils down to how fast can your strongest player move while carrying 200 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got somebody who's like, yeah, I can basically sprint, you know, for a good amount of time carrying 200 pounds, if that were true, and I'm not sure, I'm not an athlete, and I've never tried running carrying 200 pounds, but if that were true, the challenge could be over very quickly because a tribe of people who is tethered together can, of course, only move as fast as its slowest member.
Mm-hmm.
So in theory, if that person can run really fast, the challenge could be over very quickly if everybody unclips right at once.
Yeah. A little bit, though, of a prisoner's dilemma, perhaps, because now if both tribes attempt that strategy, then we could end up with just like the same exact thing, but now you have three or four people carrying all this weight.
Yeah, you could end up with two very tired people, each of whom cannot carry 200 pounds and are just waiting for the tide to rise until they drown and the challenge ends.
Yeah, they're just people just be sort of like a dead.
It's not good TV.
It would not be good TV, but I think it might be interesting at least to sort of see that sort of mad dash in the end. I mean, I think that the time that it worked the best was certainly in Palau. I think that that's where it was super iconic, where in this, you know, prolonged battle between Oolong and Karor, this was really one of the major milestones in Karor's dominance over Oolong.
Yes, as in so many instances, Karor was better organized. You know, I think everybody would probably agree, you know, Tom Westman had among his many great characteristics, he was a great leader and he helped his tribe, you know, work together. They knew, you know, when they were in the shallows, they could pick up the pace and gain ground a little bit at a time. And Oolong, you know, was kind of disorganized. They were just kind of slogging on and just hoping for the best. The thing about this challenge, I love it very, very much. This is not a challenge where the underdog usually comes from behind. This is mm-hmm. usually a challenge where the winning tribe just closes the gap bit over bit. This is not like a Jay Byers is the last to the puzzle and then figures it out. You know,
you can't catch up.
It's really hard to catch up because if you imagine, like, I've got a tribe behind me that's about to catch me, I've got to lap them mm-hmm. in order to catch up from behind. So usually once a tribe starts to win, usually it ends up, well, always actually, every time it's been played, it ends up going to that tribe.
Yeah, the thing that is interesting about it, though, visually, is that it's a physical challenge, but it's almost in some ways like an endurance challenge for a team.
100%. You know, Jeff always says that this is the challenge that be won by the team that wants it more. You lose this one when you've got nothing left in the tank, when there's somebody closing in behind you and you are too spent to run. It is very much an endurance mm-hmm. challenge.
Plus, there's also that strategic element of when people should tap out in terms of like handing off their weight to other people. So it's surprising to me that we've only seen this run four times.
Four is a lot. There's not very many challenges that have been played more than four times. There are several. I guess I should walk that back. It's been played a lot. Four times is a pretty good number. But yeah, it is such a great tribal challenge, and it's, you know, totally fair, and there's so many opportunities for strategy. I think what you were saying about Philip is really on point. You know, not to pile on the specialist, but he really played it wrong for a number of reasons. This was one of the challenges that I went and rewatched a couple of the versions. I watched the Gabon version, which Corinne sat out. Her tribe won. She wasn't in it. She was the sit out for that one.
Had a good seat to overview everything.
Yeah, and she was able to watch the other tribe really, really fall apart. in Karamoan, you know, a couple of the ways in which Philip went wrong. I think let's give Philip the benefit of the doubt and say that he wasn't, you know, compensating, but he really thought that his strategy was going to make sense. Where he went wrong was saying, well, we've got to walk because if we run, the girls will get tired. I think it's a little condescending. You could say we as a tribe.
And a little bit, yeah, projecting.
That's where he went wrong. He was also, when people clipped out, nobody gave their weight to Philip. Mm-hmm. They gave their weight to, I can't remember. One of his tribe mates. So Philip was only carrying 20 pounds.
Yeah, I don't remember who was playing in the challenge. I remember, you know, it's Corinne, Philip, Cochrane, Dawn, and then Matt, Michael, and Julia are the people on that tribe.
Philip ended the game with only his original 20 pounds. And I think where he went wrong, and this can be the case with, you know, your strategy and with your votes as well. If you're focusing too much on the future and neglecting the past, if you're saying we can't run, if we run, we'll get tired, while they're closing in on you, you're not going to get to that point of the game if you don't start running.
Right. Also, one of the other things I remember from this challenge, Brenda sitting out is really adorable as she's like dancing that they're going to win and get sandwiches or whatever.
The optimal strategy for this game is to have Brenda as your cheerleader because she's dancing around. You remember she had some fun.
That was not what the Miami Dolphins found out.
Is that the case? I'll take your word for that.
Yes.
It didn't help them.
No.
Maybe she wasn't allowed to, you know, contribute her own dialogue. Maybe that was a problem.
Maybe.
Because she had some fun interplay with Jeff where Jeff is calling out how badly Philip's leadership is hurting the tribe. If it's a strategy, it's a strange one. And Brenda echoes that. It's a strange one.
Yeah.
Another small character detail from this challenge. I'm a giant Eric Reichenbach fan. I'm aware of his shortcomings as a strategist, but as a character, as a competitor, I really love Eric. Eric is the one who reaches out and tags the other team, ending the challenge for his tribe. He pats Philip on the back, and Philip was at the front of the pack, so that's how bad their tribe was, that Eric, at the front of the tribe behind Philip's tribe, was able to reach Philip. He taps him, ending the challenge, but then he gives him the pat on the back, like one competitor to another. Hey, buddy, you know, bad beat, but, you know, it was just like Eric didn't have a lot of dialogue in Carrot Moen, but oftentimes his gestures, spoke volumes.
You're a huge Reichenbacher.
I'm a Reichenbacher. I'm a lifelong Reichenbacher. Yeah. I'll take two scoops of Eric Reichenbach. he's out there, you know, and I know people have their objections to Eric Reichenbach, and certainly the edit did not serve him well, but he's wearing his Michael Cera from Juno running shorts, and, you know, he's a hell of an athlete, and it's great to watch him do his thing.
Yeah. All right. So that we've cracked this, that the move is to go all in at the beginning. If you lose, you're probably going to lose anyway.
I'd be curious to see a tribe give that a shot. We had Jeff from Palau who said that his ankle was hurt. He clipped out right away. If you're going to clip out right away. And the other thing I think is important with this is the orchestration of how people hand their weight off, because that can cost you time. Watching this challenge, oftentimes the tribe comes to a full stop when people are disengaging from the weight. And that can really hurt you when there's a tribe closing in on you.
Now, is the exception if there is a mismatch and it's in your favor, like if you have the more physically dominant team, like we end up seeing sometimes, especially like post-swap, where one tribe is more stacked against the other. I feel like that this is more of an underdog emergent strategy where it's like, hey, we've only got like three good athletes on this team. Mm-hmm. Let's make that dash. Whereas opposed to, we have six or seven strong athletes on our team. Let's just go with that Philip strategy of, okay, let's just, you know, eventually we will catch up to them. It doesn't matter what they do early on.
Well, I would say never go with Philip's strategy from this challenge under any circumstances, because if they're coming at you, you should run. But I do agree that I think just like in Survivor, there's not one winning strategy. It kind of based on what the circumstances around you are. You could say if you're going to have people who are going to clip out, maybe give them extra weight for a little bit of the while. And so then have them pat, like, let's say you've got, Susie carrying three sandbags until she's going to clip out. And then have her give them to the strong people. So the strong people aren't carrying the maximum weight for the entire time. That could be a little bit of a help. Mm-hmm. And then I think if you have the stronger tribe, I would say a good hack is just pay attention to tempo. If you can keep track, like, you know, almost like a drummer might, if you can keep track of the pace at which the other tribe is going and coach your tribe, Tom Westman style, to have your pace just a little bit faster.
Right.
It's an inevitability.
Right. And especially with the tide where, okay, it's shallow tide here. Let's pick up the pace
here.
Yeah,
that I think is clutch if you're playing it in the water.
Okay. Good job on Hot Pursuit.
Hot Pursuit,
if it comes back.
Solved, yes.
Okay, good.
So let's talk about a challenge that we have not seen for a little while that's strictly mental, and that's the concentration game, the memory matching game. You get to look under two baskets, and if you find two items that are a pair, you get to keep them.
Okay.
This game is sometimes played for reward, and sometimes the items that you find, you can bring them back to camp instead of scoring a point for your tribe. And so then the tribe who gets the most points is the winner.
Yes. Now, I feel like that this is one that visually on TV is not often really compelling.
I think that's a strong case. It's not a lot of people's favorite challenge, but we're not talking about what is the best for entertainment value. We're talking to a listener of your podcast who's going to be a future survivor who wants to go in there with every advantage. And a lot of this is presupposing that they, you know, can listen to this podcast, remember it, you know, even when they're out there in the elements.
Well, if they can't remember this, then I think that they're probably already done in the memory challenge.
That's, yeah, they won't have
this
any
hope.
This
is the first test of the memory challenge.
Can you remember
round
this?
One. Can you remember this?
But you've also got to have your tribe listen to you. You know, if you tell them, whether it's Hot Pursuit or Concentration, if you gather your tribe around and go, guys, this is how we are going to win this challenge. If they don't believe you, or if they don't listen to you, or if they don't follow your directions, it's not necessarily going to work. But we're saying, in a best case scenario, what could we arm a theoretical future survivor with to help them win in these challenges? And let's say they bring memory out. Let's say they bring concentration out. This is a challenge that should be winnable 100% of the time. With a strategy that nobody yet has used on Survivor. And this is very basic. This is not something that I came up with. This is a strategy that has actually been implemented on The Genius in a somewhat similar game where you look behind two panels.
Mm-hmm.
The game of concentration is played that when it's your turn, you get to lift up two items.
Yes.
And so the optimal strategy is, if you lift up your first item and it's a snorkel mask,
okay,
and you don't already know where the snorkel mask is, you have two choices. If you lift up an item that nobody has seen yet, you are giving information away to the other tribe for free. So if your first item is not one that you can match, the second item you lift up should be one that everybody has already seen. Does that make sense? Did I explain that well?
Right. So if you don't know what it is, then don't just be wildly guessing. The chances are that you are going to give the information to the other team that they can make a match at least. Okay, I have no idea where this is. Let me just punt.
Yeah, and you could give away information that causes the other team to score a point on their next turn.
Yes.
So don't give information away for free.
Mm-hmm.
If both tribes are doing this strategy, then it neutralizes each other. But if one tribe is doing it, the other tribe is probably going to pick up on it. The other thing in terms of remembering where items are that I think should be really – this game should be really easy. Memory or concentration is, you know, you play it with your kid and you play one-on-one. If you've got a team of people, there's no reason why they shouldn't all be able to remember where things are. And again, this is in a best case scenario. The strategy I would suggest is, if the items are laid out in a grid – as a tribe, privately, assign them letters and numbers. So there are coordinates. There's no coordinates written on the game board. You decide ahead of time, hey, guys, that's going to be A, B, C, D, E.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Each person only needs to remember a couple of things. You've got 8 people on your tribe. Hey, I want you to remember that the hat is at G4. G4 mm-hmm. hat. You got that? So you've only got everybody on your tribe remembering a couple of things. Then whoever's turn it is, the person who knows where that item is, just tells them where it is, right? By delegating and distributing the memory among the whole tribe, you can leverage the power of everybody's brains. This game should be very, very winnable.
The tricky part is that sometimes that they're just sort of like scattered around mm-hmm. in terms of like, it's like some sort of like, there's no grid in terms of where things are laid out.
It may be an irregular grid, but if you can come up with some sort of notation system that your tribe agrees on. And the important part is farming out, remembering where each item is. People also often just pick up an item like from the middle of the board. It seems to me like you would probably want to go methodically, like just start at one end and uncover items from one side, you know, from one mm-hmm. row to the next. Like, you don't have to be fancy about it. Treat it like a Jeopardy category. Go from top to bottom
mm-hmm.
and, you know, just reveal where things are.
Yeah. The memory game on Survivor was last run during Redemption Island, on Redemption Island, where Matt Elrod was the winner of that. I believe it was it Christina Kell that he beat on Redemption Island in the memory game while he was on his run? Or it might have been, I think it was Stephanie Valencia, Steph Valencia.
And the fact that we haven't seen the game since Redemption Island, I think serves your point that although it's...
Or Matt Elrod.
We haven't seen... Boy, I can't imagine that guy agreeing to come back. He's like, I kind of remember last time when God abandoned me. My beloved God forsook me on Redemption Island for 28 days. I'll pass. I think that most people kind of agree with you. It's a fair game. It's a mental game. It's not the most compelling and dramatic TV. But should they bring it back... There's no reason why your tribe shouldn't be able to win this if you've listened to this podcast.
Should it come back, or should Wyatt Nash come back?
Oh, either is that one. Matt Elrod's name
that's,
now?
That's his puzzler name.
That's his nom. Yes. He is Wyatt Nash. Oh, boy. I wonder what that anagrams to. Oh, I know. It anagrams to Nyatt Wash. That's what it's an anagram of.
All right. All right. So concentration game. Check.
Let's talk about memory across the board, because there are sporadically, Jeff seems to sort of swing back and forth, and he does it sort of publicly as to whether he likes memory challenges or not.
Okay.
But they come up often enough that we should talk a little bit about memory tactics.
Like sort of a Simon type game of like, give us this order back of something that we just gave you this item.
Yeah. And now, actually, before we get into kind of my notes here, you played a memory game in the Amazon. You guys you got to look around. It was almost like a whodunit challenge. You mm-hmm. looked around a crime scene.
Yeah.
And then you went one-on-one against the other person. Jeff would answer a question. You would write.
Yeah.
Did you employ any tactics? Did you attempt to hack that memory challenge while you were looking around the room?
Well, there really was no way to hack. It was sort of like a counting challenge of that we got to go. Like, there was like this like little set that they built. And then there was like, I think that this sort of replaced where they used to like give you like a book, and then you would like have to like answer trivia questions out of the book. This was that they showed you this little house, and then you had to count. They were going to ask you like how many pancakes were there in the pan.
Did they tell you ahead of time that it was going to be counting, or did you just figure what else are they going to ask questions about?
Yeah, I think that what else are they going to ask questions about? I don't remember what the exact instructions were, but we sort of say, okay, oh, there's like 8 chickens in the coop, and I had gotten a question right, which was how many steps were on the ladder, and I had thought to count that, but it was just sort of like just running around, just like counting everything, and then trying to remember all those numbers.
And you didn't agree ahead of time, hey guys, you look at that corner and I'll look at that corner.
We did not have that kind of organization, and it really would not have helped, because it wasn't a team, like you were asked the questions one at a time, so it wasn't like, you know, a Family Feud type steal
you
where I
confer.
Could sort of like, okay, what do you guys think? Or I mean, maybe you could have like Price is Right style, what do you think?
That would have been good.
Yeah. So maybe if that was the case, and Dan Liu was at the challenge and the Survivor Price is Right.
Is he the only person who has that distinction that he was at that challenge and Price is
Right? I don't think anybody else from the Amazon was there that day. So yeah, I think Dan Liu, he's it.
Is that your Alex Bell?
Yeah, Alex Bell. Too bad Ryan Aiken was there. Like, Ryan, what do you bid on the love seat?
I bid 2 cents.
That was pretty cheap.
2 cents is pretty cheap.
Yeah, it's pretty cheap. Okay, so... In terms of memory challenges for Survivor.
So my wife is a neuroscientist, and I talked to her.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, she's a bright lady, and she's a huge Survivor fan, so she's got a lot of positive attributes.
Okay.
So we talked a little bit about memory, and, you know, there are, if you didn't think that the National Puzzlers League convention was a nerdy enough thing to do for fun, there are memory competitions. There are people who are competitive memorists, where they have to do things like, we give you a long string of numbers, or we're going to shuffle a deck of cards and show it to you in an order, or we're going to read you a poem that is basically gibberish, and you have to repeat it back. Memory is something that you can train for, and it seems like that could be a good thing to drill when you're planning to go on Survivor, because even if they're not going to do individual memory challenges, although we had one just in this most recent season. We had Michelle swim out to a platform where there were animals associated with numbers, and then she had to know them in order to open a combination lock back at the shore. So drilling memory seems like it would be a worthwhile skill to have going into Survivor. And there's a great book by Bob Harris called Lost in Trebekistan. Bob Harris is a Jeopardy champion, and he talks about how he wasn't a guy who had a lot of education. You know, he wasn't necessarily what you might think of as a smart guy, but he trained to go on Jeopardy, and he trained his brain to be able to hold and absorb a lot of information. And he drew upon something that my wife, the neuroscientist, told me about, which is that the memory center and the emotion center of the brain are right next to each other. They're part of the same system. They're part of the limbic system, which is very timely because last night was the big debut of the Olympic Games.
Okay.
The old Olympic Games. And so what Bob Harris writes in his book is that if you're going on Jeopardy and you want to learn the presidents, the state capitals, Shakespeare's play, the kind of stuff that you're going to be asked about on Jeopardy, he says your brain is like Homer Simpson on a roller coaster. It wants something thrilling. It wants explosions. It wants something that's, sexually provocative. So remembering things by tying them to things that Homer Simpson would find interesting is a useful memory hack. You can read more about it in Bob Harris's book. But by tying abstract things that you're trying to remember, by tying them to emotions, it's going to help your brain retain them better.
Okay.
Something else that I learned about what are memory techniques?
Well, can you just drill down a little bit on that? So if I'm getting a challenge and it's like, okay, shovel, sailboat, compass, knife, sailboat. What am I attaching those things to?
So one way to do it, and the Bob Harris example might not be the best one in this instance. I'm actually going to, you could remember like, oh, shovel. Okay, well, I'm going to take a shovel and I'm going to bash in the brain of somebody that I hate. Okay, so now you've taken...
Good Lord.
Well, the reason I say that is you take the shovel, which is an abstract item that's not connected to any emotion, and then you connect it to something that is like very emotionally... powerful and vivid.
Right. Okay.
And that's going to make it stand out in your memory because of the limbic system.
Okay.
But another way to do it, there's a technique that I guess originated with the ancient Greeks. So look how high-minded we are on this podcast. We're talking about all kinds of sophisticated stuff.
Yes.
The memory temple. Okay. So here's what I would do. If Jeff has just read you a list of abstract items, this is a technique that could work for you. You know, your mileage may vary. You picture a place that you know really well, maybe your home or your childhood home. And you picture yourself walking in the door, and the first item that Jeff listed, a shovel, picture a shovel in your entry hall. You've now tied it to something that you know really well. Then turn to your left and picture the next item. So you're basically creating like a trail of breadcrumbs, like Hansel and Gretel, through an area that you know really well. So you're connecting something abstract that you don't know to something that you do know really well, and it's going to help your brain remember them better.
Okay.
It's called the memory temple.
The memory temple.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, it's worth a shot.
And these do come up a lot. We've seen these from their first appearance, according to the Survivor Wiki, in Survivor China, where PG won. We've seen them recently in Blood versus Water, in Cagayan, in San Juan del Sur. So this is something that, it seems like I'd be surprised if we get past Survivor 33 and 34 without this coming up.
We remember the great Stephen Fishback. He was able to cover a huge gap on a balance beam obstacle course.
Yes.
By being the person who did the best job remembering the mathematical operation symbols that were at the far end of the obstacle course. And in his mat chat after the challenge was over, he said that he translated each of them to a number, and he said the human mind can remember 10 pieces of information, which is why telephone numbers are 10 digits long. So he just gave himself a telephone number to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when this came up in Koh Rong, which we were just talking about, Michelle swam out to a platform and she memorized all the animals. As I was watching this challenge, I said, oh, this is so hackable. The deal was, back at the beach, there were five animals that you needed. But the first thing you had to do was swim out into the water where there were 12 animals, each one tied to a numeral. You could spend as much time as you wanted out on the floating platform before you came back to the beach. And then of those up to 12 that you might have memorized, you had to translate the five animals into numerals. Here's what I said as I was watching TV, me and my infinite wisdom. I was like, now here's what you do. Swim out to the platform, touch it. Don't spend a minute memorizing those 12 animals.
Right.
Swim back to the beach, learn which five you're going to need, and return to the floating platform. So you're only memorizing five things instead of 12 or 20 or whatever number it was.
Yes.
That was what I said. And I was wrong, because both Michelle and Julia memorized everything they needed to know on a single trip. I was saying the person who wins this is going to be the first person to get to the platform and back twice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was dead wrong. Michelle and Julia memorized.
Co-wrong.
I couldn't have been co-wrong. Michelle and Julia memorized it all on their first go. I had a chance to ask Michelle about that. I attended the reunion.
Yes.
And I asked Michelle, so how did you memorize those 20 numbers associated with animals. And she was like, I just memorized them all in one go.
She likes animals.
She likes animals.
Yeah.
Sometimes the answer to the question about how did you win that challenge is really disappointing. I know I wrote in when you had Laura Moret as a guest on the show.
Yes.
I asked you this question to pose to Laura Moret, which is she won my favorite immunity challenge of all time, which was square peg round hole. It was in Samoa, and you had to put these wooden blocks into a board, and each one you placed correctly would push another block out, and it would fall down into a trough. And this was a challenge that Shambo ended the game holding the first piece in her hand, you know, looking at it kind of blankly. So I asked you to ask Laura, how did you win that challenge? And her answer was something along the lines of, God just told me the answers.
Oh.
So that must be nice. But that wasn't – sometimes the answer to how did you win that challenge is kind of not what you're hoping it will be.
Do you have any emergent strategies about God?
I mean, it didn't work for Matt Elrott, for Wyatt Nash, so I don't know.
It did for a while.
Did it?
Yeah.
Yeah. He won a lot of challenges.
He had a good run.
He had a good run of wins. I don't know if that – it didn't make his experience that great.
Worked for Mike Holloway?
It worked for Mike Holloway. Well, I mean, the history of people who love God and who think that God smiles on them, who then can't win Survivor, that's a long list of people.
Yeah. Okay. So that would be a whole nother podcast of what are these people doing right and what did the other people do wrong?
Yes. Why did God love Nalia less than Vesepia?
Well, I mean, let's not get too far off the beaten path, but I think that Vesepia did put her work in with the good Lord quite a bit in Marquesas.
Yes. Well, if it came down to, fortunately, it did not come down to which of these two people loves God more.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
That's not a reality show.
That was not a question.
I would not tune in to watch that one.
Yes. Although.
You are both the epitome of what this great country of ours has to offer.
Didn't think it would be a reason to go to that so quick. Didn't think that would happen, but there it is.
You are well prepared.
For that question, I was.
Oh, you've got all the stuff that you need. All the stuff that yes. you need for yourself.
My stuff! All right. Let's keep going. What other challenges do you have a hack for?
So when this question came in, this is a question from the great Jessica Frey.
Okay.
Who said, what is the proper way to shoot a basket in the Survivor version of basketball? And how do you beat an NBA player?
Yeah. Well, I did hear Malcolm Gladwell on a podcast recently talking with Bill Simmons about how more people should be shooting free throws underhand.
That is what I came in with my answer to Jessica. The first thing I did was I laughed at this question. Like, Jessica, you're asking a guy with dad bod how to beat an NBA player in a one-on-one basketball challenge.
Yes.
But on Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History, he talks about, do you remember the name of the NBA player who he cites as an example of this? This is a memory challenge. Think about killing someone with a shovel and you'll remember this name.
The person who he says should be doing this or the person that used to do it?
The NBA player who's famous for the underhand granny shot.
If I had multiple choice, I could do it, but the Rick Barry?
It is Rick Barry. Ring the bell.
Yes.
Your memory is on point.
It's okay.
It's on fleek.
I had to memorize that I had killed Rick Barry and then so I was able to recall that
and
information.
And you could bury him with a shovel. So
yeah,
it's all
underhand,
comes full circle.
Underhand.
It was an underhanded thing to do.
Yes.
Yeah, he had a better percent, and I'm not conversant in sports. So this might be more in your wheelhouse, but he was better at free throws than Wilt Chamberlain because he threw underhand.
Yes.
The example, and Malcolm Gladwell kind of ties this in with the notion of a riot. You may have heard this. I heard him on This American Life. You heard him on Bill Simmons.
Yeah.
But he talks about what causes a law-abiding citizen to participate in a riot and throw a brick through a storefront window. You know, there's some people who all they need to do is see one other person in civil distress and civil unrest and they will join in. Whereas, you know, your grandmother, she wouldn't participate in a riot unless everyone she knew, all her friends and family and everybody from her sewing circle, if they were rioting in the streets, maybe she would join them. So it's like a threshold of how many other people need to be doing it before you need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
A guy like Rick Barry is someone who, just based on his nature and who he is, he doesn't care what other people are doing. He doesn't care what other people think of him or if other people laugh at him because his results were really, really good. He hit almost every free throw. So all kidding aside, if you are in a basketball challenge and you're on Survivor and you're going up against a former NBA player, throw underhand.
See, I think that maybe there is more room for, like, there's more downside, perhaps. Let me just talk this through. Okay,
yes.
So one, you're going underhand and if you're not hitting that, basically, if you're shooting the regular way and you're missing, it's like, okay, you're missing. But if you're trying, if you're going against the grain, you're doing something different. First, now, Jeff is killing you. Miles, what is here that he's got a new idea? Boy, that's not working. Oh, go back to the drawing board on that one. And you lose the challenge now to not just because the narrative isn't, hey, I gave it my best shot, but what am I doing? I'm going up against an NBA player. Now you were going up against an NBA player and also you had a crazy idea. So now in, you know, in the basketball game, I guess it could be like if you lose the game because you shot underhand, now the narrative is, okay, you guys lost this game because you had this crazy idea. Now you start to become somebody that is maybe on the chopping block, but that it's a reason for people to point to you to vote you out.
That's an excellent point. I didn't think about that. There's more at play than do the journalists in the sports pages think that you're foolish?
Yes.
If the tribe thinks like you had an opportunity to win this challenge, but because you did the underhand shot, that could hurt you when it comes to tribal council, should you lose. But if you win with your underhand shots, then it doesn't matter what they think of you.
Yeah, then you're the hero.
For themselves.
Then you're the hero. But is there enough upside there? I guess if you are practicing your free throws and you're like, well, I could hit this underhand, no problem. But if you have this crazy idea, if you attempt this hack and you lose because you went outside the box, I think there's more of a reason for people to point the finger at you. You could become the scapegoat easier.
Yes, there's a lot more potential downside. The person who puts himself in that position, the Spencer, if you will, who goes up against Uncle Cliffy, mm-hmm. right? Or you had, who was the fella from Korong?
It was Nick.
Nick going up against Scott.
Yes.
Anytime you put yourself in the point position in an instance like that, there's the risk that, you know, you can be the hero or you can be the goat.
Yes, I've had this same phenomenon in the car with my wife where I insist on using ways to take a different route to get where we're going. In fact, the day that we were supposed to have Anthony be induced at the hospital, we had an appointment. And I said, okay, trust me, I've got the ways. Let's go this way. And she was like, no, don't get off the 101. I said, no, we're doing it. And boy, we did not get there on time, that was not a pleasant day.
I'm not touching that one.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, I see why you're saying now you're attuned to the risk of the off the beaten path strategy.
Yes.
And that is, you know, there's so much conflict in Survivor and so many things to battle. If the challenges existed in a vacuum and you had the opportunity to try an outside the box strategy that could succeed or could fail. I don't know why this example springs to mind, but you have Cowboy in the fire making challenge in Cook's Island 1, mm-hmm. had a very non-traditional, he was waving around a little pile of straw, you know, to expose it to the air. And Jeff was like, Cowboy is going to look very smart or very foolish.
Yes.
Those don't exist in a vacuum because what your tribe thinks of you and if you're contributing to the challenges, it has an impact when you go to tribal council. So yeah, it's a difficult thing to balance.
Yeah. Could be hero, could be the goat.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. All right. What else you got?
Okay. So here's one. This is wide open. All right. So I'd be curious to talk it out with you. You get the touchy subjects style challenge.
Right.
Where you have the or any challenge where you have the opportunity to chop the other players.
Okay, so better known as the coconut chop challenge. Some different version. We've done this many, many times. You know, famously back in Marquesas, but where that was more, I believe it was a quiz. It started out.
Sometimes
then.
You answer trivia questions. Sometimes you weigh in on what the other people in the tribe think of you. Earning, getting a question right gives you the opportunity to chop at another player. Three chops takes them out.
Right. In later seasons, they sort of merged the sort of slam book with this, where then you could get people who are mad that they gave their name and then also cutting the rope. So certainly a challenge that has been well played out during Survivor history.
And we know the best way not to do it, which is the way that the Road to 4 did it in Marquesas.
Yeah, don't give away the pecking order.
Yeah, and you know, to be fair, like in hindsight, it seemed clear that that was a bad thing to do. But that challenge had never been done before. You know, how were they to know? When it comes to the slam book version, my understanding is that they're doing that less often because the survivors have kind of found a way to hack it, sort of like we're talking about. This is a game that the majority alliance can basically be assured to win every time if they just get, let's say it's 5 against 4, and they get the books are dropped off at camp and they're told to all go answer the questions. If they get together and go, hey, Stacy, we're just going to put you as the answer to every negative question. If they can agree ahead of time on how to answer the questions, then the game is hacked, and that, you know, it's not fun to watch, mm-hmm. you know, a pagonging within a challenge.
Yeah, see, I didn't know that that was as much of a thing as I and we did this challenge basically the slam book. I think the first iteration of this challenge we did in the Amazon, and we were all like sort of like sequestered mm-hmm. for like not sequestered, but like they told us like, hey, don't talk about these things. Like they were, you know, don't share your answers with other people. And then I don't remember who won the challenge in back in the Amazon, but I'm sure it was a really hard fought. But in terms of how they do it now, I thought the problem was more with like how they're deciding to do the cutting of the ropes. Where I remember back in San Juan del Sur, Jeff gets like really pissed with. Yeah, Jeff gets really pissed.
Like Sandy.
Yes, and then he basically is like, you know what? Let's call the challenge off. Why don't you just tell me who you want to win the challenge? Why don't you just, who's going to win? Who's going to Exile Island? You guys have it all figured out. We don't need to, like, I'm not doing this for my health.
Yeah, he was like bloop, bloop, blooping through the challenge, like, while it was happening live.
Yes, so I believe that was the last time that they run this challenge.
Yeah, but it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, so since then... So it's interesting to see if it's going to come back. Okay, so what were you saying in terms of the hack?
Well, it turns out, yeah, based on what you were just saying, I completely agree. You have to not just tip your strategy to the minority, you can't tip your strategy to Jeff or he'll get annoyed and call off the challenge.
Yeah, there's no way for the person who's in the minority to win this challenge mm-hmm. now at this point. What do you think of the idea of, hey, if I get the question right, you can't cut my rope?
Who is speaking to whom?
So if I am a person in the challenge, like I believe Reed was the person who they were trying to get rid of at that point. And if he gets the question right, you can't cut his rope that round.
Oh, so you have like immunity from a chop. So
right. You can only get the people who got the question wrong. Because my initial hack on this challenge, and again, in the Amazon, we had two different versions of this. We had the slam book, and then we had another one that was like about trivia, but which was similar to the Marquesas coconut chop challenge. My thinking then was, I'm going to get all the questions wrong because nobody will chop me unless I chop them first. And then I ended up trying to like, I got too cute.
You got a little too cute. I remember that.
I got too cute. I wanted to like let the audience at home know I was throwing the challenge.
I'm not really that dumb.
So yeah, I was
a bush guy.
Bushmaster. Yeah. So I was like really like, I was trying to give the worst possible answer. So people at home would be like, oh yeah. Oh, he's obviously throwing it. I wanted to show how smart, yeah, which is bad. You don't want to do that. But my thinking then, which I think is still the correct thinking is you don't want to be chopping anybody's rope because then that makes people like, well, you chop me, so let me chop you.
Completely agree. So you're saying from a game design perspective, what if the rule is a right answer protects you from being chopped?
Yes. And it would encourage you to get right answers.
Yes.
Because, well, I'm trying to throw this challenge. I want to get answers wrong so I don't have to chop anybody's rope.
Now, how about this? What if you get the question right, you have a choice. You can play offensive or defensive. This might be too complicated, but this is the first time it's crossing my mind. You get the question right, you have the choice. You can either chop another rope, which leaves you vulnerable to be chopped, or you can be safe for that round.
So I like it. I like it as well. So
yeah.
If I'm Reed, I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to protect my ropes. But I feel like that it might just like then you are going to get a point where we're both going to keep our rope safe. I feel like you get to a point where nobody is cutting anything.
It could last forever. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a downside.
So I think that if I got the question right, I'm protected. I'm not on the board.
So
as
you
a person.
Get to chop and cannot chop others.
Right. And if everybody gets it right, nobody gets to chop anything.
Yeah. That's a very interesting iteration.
Let's do it.
Going to Samoa.
It's going to Samoa. I still think that, you know, in that scenario where everybody wants Reed out or Troyzan out, you know, and we get to these situations where, you know, there's like one person where everybody is sort of like trying to get rid of them. I still think that they're really drawing dead. But like back in the Amazon, it's like, okay, Dave Johnson is going home today. So it's like, okay, everybody. Sorry, Dave. Like, yep. Bangarang.
Bangarang.
Yeah. Sorry.
Sorry, The Righteous Dave. It's a hopeless case. Yeah.
K. Garnet, Garnet.
That was pretty cheap, bro.
Yeah, that was pretty cheap.
That was pretty cheap.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, and then you take the person, I'd say a problem with that challenge is the person who is most in need of immunity can't get it. It's rare that the other survivors have a say in who wins immunity, right? If you're playing When It Rains, okay, you stick your hand up over your head, you're going to win or lose based on your own merit. You can't go over and tug on somebody else's bucket and take them out of the challenge. This game is the exception to that. So the players have a say in who wins.
Yeah, so at least like if there's two or three people in the minority, they've got at least a fighting chance now where there was just, it was hopeless. It's hopeless. And we've seen all through Survivor history, every time they run some version of this, the person who they don't want to win always goes out first or second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting idea. And again, I think you're right. I think you are going to be drawing dead in this challenge. But if you can get organized, if you are in the minority and you can get a little bit organized, and I think if you talk it out, you want to foment dissension among the majority as much as you can, because even the majority gets annoyed when they chop each other.
Mm-hmm.
I was unhappy when Jeff called off the challenge. I understand his reasons for doing so, but I think for one thing, the props in that challenge were kind of beautiful. They had these skulls, and when you smashed them, blood would ooze out of them. Had Jeff not called the challenge off, and had they had to play the thing out, if you have John Mish cutting the last rope and smash Jacqueline's skull, like just based on the way that the rotation goes, and he causes the blood to ooze out of her skull, that's going to create drama back at camp. And I think we were shortchanged by that.
Or at least
a
visual
bit.
For a future memory challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Very vivid in the memory temple.
Yes.
As the blood oozes out of Jacqueline's memory temples.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair point. I think that just in defense of Jeff there, I think he thought that like, okay, well, if we're not going to get that from the game, at least let's get that from, okay, let's skip the step and take the pretense out of it. Okay, why don't you just pick who gets to go on reward here today instead of like doing it through the mechanism of the game? It was like, all right, well, since you guys are all on the same page, then just pick who's going to go to Redemption Island. Pick who doesn't go on the reward. So I think that his hope was that to create some dissension there. And it did kind of work where Jacqueline did go back, you know, that day and sort of like Reed was like, see, Jacqueline, how come you're back here? How come you didn't get to go on reward? She's like, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you did end up with Jacqueline and John getting into the big fight in that same episode.
Yes.
Because of that. And then she wanted to talk to him about like what she had learned. And he's like, ah, come on. I just want to talk to my girlfriend. It's like, oh, you don't want to hear what I have to say. And then that was a whole,
yeah, it's almost like John doesn't pick up the phone when people call him, you know.
Yeah miss signal. So I think that would be a hack,
a missed signal.
Yes, missed signals. So I think this would be more of a hack on the production side of it to try to fix the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Fix a challenge that has been hacked.
Yes, it is incumbent on the team. And it hasn't come up in the challenge room for a while. The other like small criticism I might add about the San Juan del Sur version of it is they were neither trivia questions about, you know, their surroundings nor slam book questions. They were trivia questions about the contestants, you know, who graduated from such and such college.
Yeah.
And they were all getting them all right.
Yes.
Which is kind of like the least optimal version.
Yes. Yes. So better than trivia questions about the location, but worse than the touchy subjects.
Probably yes.
Yes, yeah. Because I mean, going back to, you know, when they used to do that in the final, that used to be like the final four immunity of like the notebook
oh,
question.
Yeah.
And then it's like, wait, you didn't know that about me? So, you know, you could earn points with somebody or gets lose points with somebody it's like, oh, you don't know my kids' names?
Yeah.
Where, you know, Kelly Wigglesworth, the first, you know, knew Rudy's wife's name, even though he didn't vote for her in the end, but like knew Jenna Lewis's kids' names and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I think also in the Clay and Brian, you know, it played out really bad. Didn't Penny like chew Clay out for not knowing enough about her?
Yeah, I think it was something like that. Or no, I think it was the opposite. I think that that Clay knew everything about Penny. Like he was kind of like a little bit of a pervy guy, and he kind of like knew everything. Like the women, he paid like a lot of attention to them. And it was
no
like,
wonder he played so well with Ted.
Right. With Brian didn't know anything.
Oh, yeah, because Brian was just skating. He was just the ice
he could
man.
Just like he couldn't care less about knowing any personal details about anybody.
Well, there you go. Yeah, it's been so long since I watched Thailand. It's dim in the recesses of my memory.
I am 150 to 200% happy with the wife that I have.
Yes, yes.
Hey, you want to know my hack for Mike Holloway's voice?
What's that?
You just talk like Bill Clinton trying not to yawn.
I am 155,000%.
I was not sleeping. Yeah. So, that's good. That's good. Good impression hack, too.
Good impression hack. Yeah, Bill Clinton trying not to yawn. All right, so the great, let's see, the Ariel Kalish Glassman from the patron group.
Yes.
She asked about hacking a blindfolded maze.
Okay, Ariel wants to hack a blindfolded maze. Information that would have been useful like 13 years ago.
I was going to throw it to you since you have a little more experience.
No, I don't have any good answers to this.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if there's a, I don't know what, you know, they say that in a labyrinth, you're always supposed to turn left and that you'll get to the center that way. I don't know if that's the case in survivor mazes. They come in so many different shapes and sizes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a great answer for that. But with blindfolded calling games, I do have a couple potential hacks. This is where one person is up on the tower yelling at everybody else who's blindfolded and mm-hmm. having them retrieve stuff. I think based on the version that we see that's cut for TV, I think the callers don't rely on names enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important that you start and end every direction that you yell to a blindfolded person with their name to get them to pay attention. It's almost like saying stop at the end of a telegraph.
Yeah.
I think that that's really important.
Or talking to Siri.
Oh, do you have to say stop?
No, but you can put punctuation at the end of sentences, like period, exclamation point, question mark.
Oh, well, that's a good hack as well. Yes. Really, between
phone hacks.
Between the telegraph. Oh, no, we don't want hacked phones.
No, not that way.
We just covered quite a gamut of technology between telegrams and Siri. We just encompassed like 100 years of technology in a heartbeat.
Yes, yes.
The other thing I think that is maybe perhaps underreported or maybe underutilized is the notion of the pitch or timbre or frequency of the voice of the person you're listening to. I have been in blindfolded calling games where I will tell my team before we begin, hey, I'm going to be speaking like at a low, like just focus on the low frequency because I'm going to be speaking kind of a low voice. And it kind of like if there's two or even three callers based on how many tribes are in the game, just disambiguating the visual, the audio noise when you're blindfolded and you've got all these signals. Definitely Sarge, from the Lepevi tribe. He was great at this challenge. He was a drill sergeant. He had those, powerful lungs. You could really hone in on his voice. Whereas Cass, when she was a caller in a blindfolded challenge, it was almost like Keith Nail had a lot of experience at tuning out the frequencies of mm-hmm. women's voices. Mm-hmm. She was shouting at him and he was just not responding.
Right. Also, I think that from a production side, I think that they are probably best served to do this early on. I think that when we went through the evolution of strategy, it was typically you'd see this episode or this challenge come up a lot, like second episode, which I think was the right time to have it because I remember back in the Amazon, we had Butch as the caller and he couldn't remember anybody's names early on.
That's devastating.
Which is a problem. And I think is also something that's good to sort of mess up the social dynamics of like, we lost this challenge because this guy doesn't even know my name. Or it'll be like, blue shirt.
Yeah.
And that's really bad. Whereas if you do it like day 15, everybody knows each other's names. Also, another interesting thing with these blindfold challenges, which I tend to not like because
you're
people
very
get
risk
hurt.
Averse. Yeah.
I don't understand. It's not like it's such compelling television. I think you have a big opportunity to like concuss somebody and lose a player, which I don't think that the juice is worth the squeeze, to quote the great Alec Christie. But I did like it back in Gabon, where they had like this blindfold bowling challenge, and Randy was shouting out, like,
that's an all-star moment.
Yeah, that's a really great moment.
Sugar was so hapless as the caller that Randy from the other tribe was yelling at Sugar's tribe mate Ace and giving him bad directions.
Yes, the opposite directions.
And Ace was so desperate for somebody to talk to him.
Which is good. So I feel like that should more people should do that. I mean, I think it pisses people off. So maybe you have a chance to get voted out because of somebody like end up having animosity towards you. But I did feel like it was a great TV moment.
I take your point on the blindfold challenges, but people get hurt during all kinds of challenges. Survivor is an inherently risky game, and I don't disagree that blindfolds raise. But Michelle fell off the platform during a blindfold challenge in Fiji, and she wasn't the blindfolded person. So
that's true. That is true. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that we're they're never going to get rid of blindfolded challenges, okay. Is my opinion. I think it does. I know you say it's not the most compelling and the juice is not worth the squeeze. I think that there's enough voices who kind of take the other side on that. I don't think the blindfolded challenges are going away.
Okay. I'll stand, much like Michelle Yeoh, I will stand on my platform until I fall off.
But if you come up smiling, then you can be America's favorite just like Michelle.
Fine.
Let's talk. Speaking of falling, let's talk about this challenge that is called By the Numbers.
Okay.
So this is your tribe. It's usually done in the men versus women seasons, and you're on a balance beam.
Yes, one person
has to go from the far end of the balance beam to the other.
Okay.
This is the commemorative Kat Ederson needless diving challenge.
Yes. It's been run in Vanuatu. We did it back again in the One World, and also we did it in Fiji as well.
So this was one where I went back and I watched all three iterations, and there's some really interesting emergent gameplay as people try different tactics and strategies in this game. Something that I had completely forgot about was, it was the kind of like, again, Fiji, you know, not my favorite season, not, you know, Michelle notwithstanding, it's not a season that's full of people that I really like enjoy spending my TV time with.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it was clear that nobody from One World saw and remembered the way that this game got played in Fiji, or they would have tried the hack. And the hack is the person who, okay, you've got the one person who's moving and everybody else is an obstacle. On the Moto tribe, the obstacles would kneel. They would squat down, and the moving person could pretty simply step over them like a sideways leapfrog by placing both hands on the back of the person and doing one leg over onto the balance beam. Moto was able to overcome a deficit. The Ravu tribe was leading, and when Moto determined this strategy, they came from behind to win. Mm-hmm. It was pretty game-breaking, but nobody from One World remembered it and employed it.
Yeah. Also, one of the things that you're able to do with this challenge is to put your people in a certain order. Mm-hmm. So ideally, if you have an Anthony Robinson, if you have a Kat, the person who is constantly falling in the challenge, you could put them as the closest to the end. So they don't have to cross past anybody. I think that what Survivor production seems to be going for is they like that moment where the two guys have to sort of like awkwardly like move past each other and sort of like hold each other in an embrace, and then we get to have sort of these weird moments where Jeff is like, oh, there's Troyzan and Tarzan, they're really getting to know each other.
Yep, and then you also get the same thing on the women's tribe, so there's something for everybody.
Right. Sometimes you have like two buxom women trying to get past each other. That's also a TV moment.
In the One World iteration of this game, there was a lot of talk on the women's tribe about how the boobs were a problem. Like Kat is trying to get past Monica, and she's saying, ah, she's got these big old boobs.
A pre-top-heavy Kat as well.
Imagine how poorly she would have fared at this challenge if she'd been enhanced.
She has to do it again. Oh my God. Yeah.
Now, the women's tribe, they came up with a couple strategies that were actually, you know, pretty clever. They could not overcome, you know, Kat was a real liability to the tribe in this particular challenge.
Yeah, it's ironic that it was the men that were sort of, I can't rub up against another guy. And the women had no problem in Vanuatu. And then the idiot Monono men actually had no problem with it in One World.
It was pretty astounding, yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't that the challenge where they won immunity and then forfeited it so they could go to tribal council, or that happened?
No, that was a different challenge. Okay. That was a different challenge.
It was another... Yeah, not a great decision in the history of Survivor. Yeah, all of these tribes, I feel like, did not employ the strategy that you mentioned, which is take your person who is kind of a liability, put them on the end where all they have to do is get past six times and then take two steps onto the platform.
Right.
Like the Moto tribe, they put Lisi, who I think, you know, has a lot of great characteristics, but I don't think she's like their best, maybe like most nimble athlete. They had her as their first mover, the person who had to cover the most distance. And still, when they employed this, the penitent man shall pass strategy,
yes,
where they would all kneel. Not Neil Gottlieb, not yeah, Wombat's brother.
Not Wombat Gottlieb.
Not Wombat Gottlieb. That's my least favorite flavor of Three Twins ice cream. They still were able to get Lisi across their entire tribe. So I think they had people like, there were a lot of men on the Monono tribe that I looked at. I was like, I don't remember you at all. But Michael, what I remember about Michael, what I liked about him was he stole stuff from the women's pile during the shipwreck in the first episode.
Yes.
He was the one closest to the platform and he seemed like an athletic guy. I couldn't understand why they'd put him in that position. But I think what you just described is a really good hack. A couple of things that the women tried that had a good amount of success was the mover passing behind the obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
So almost like big spoon to little spoon.
Yes.
If you're embracing, you know, kind of face to face, people tried that. They didn't have a ton of success. But going behind, the big spoon technique seemed to work pretty well.
Yes. In the Vanuatu version or in One World as well?
This was One World. Okay. I didn't rewatch the Vanuatu version, so I don't remember too much about the strategy in that one.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, when they stopped using Kat as their mover and they put Monica in that position, they also did a thing where she would almost kind of go limp and let the obstacle like kind of pick her up under the arms and move her around their front onto mm-hmm. the balance beam. That worked pretty well as well. None of it was enough to overcome the Monono team.
Yeah.
Let's talk about House of Cards.
Oh, great. Now, Miles, I'm so happy to talk about season 4 of the popular Netflix series.
President Underwood, are you
yes,
here?
Yes, yes. Underwood 2016.
Now, the best strategy in this challenge is to push your opponent...
Ashley Underwood 2016.
Push your opponent under a subway train
to win
this challenge.
Yes.
The great Molly Shock suggested that we discuss strategies for House of Cards. Now, it turns out you can read a book about building a House of Cards and it still won't necessarily help you win, as mm-hmm. Sophie discovered in the South Pacific season.
Mm-hmm.
The House of Cards game comes down not just to balance, but a lot of it comes down to card management.
Yes.
And there was two important instances of this. I teased Sophie, but her House of Cards was a beautiful structure, but she spent too many cards at the bottom of it and didn't have enough to reach the top.
Yes. And this is for, if people don't have the great memory for this, this is when Survivor gives you, they're not technically cards, but more sort of like thick dominoes that are sort of like maybe like index card size, and you have to build a tower and it needs to be a certain height. And then there's also like a time limit also where Jeff will call it sometimes after a certain amount of time. Whoever has the highest stack after 30 minutes will be the winner if nobody reaches the certain height.
And it's sometimes played on a teeter tower version where you're holding your platform with one arm and building it with the other.
Right, where if you move your arm, the entire platform could fall and then all of your dominoes / cards fall.
It's a really dandy challenge. I like watching it a lot. And I know, like, me going back and rewatching isolated challenges from within episodes, I know there are people who don't care for the challenges who just bloop, bloop, bloop through the whole thing. I get that. But to me, I would liken it to, what if you didn't want to watch all of Kill Bill, but you just wanted to watch the part where Uma Thurman kills the whole crazy 88, you know, mm-hmm. while the rock and roll band plays? To me, that's how I feel about watching these challenges isolated.
Yes.
Kind of a tangent there. But Sophie eventually, and Ozzy won with the House of Cards strategy, I think, is you want to think of it as a House of Pie, which is a great restaurant here in LA that some people have been to. But that, like, the Greek letter pie, okay, that's kind of that was the strategy that a lot of the winners use, is each layer of the House of Cards looks like the letter pie with two vertical pieces and a single horizontal piece.
Okay.
Yeah. And card management is super important. There was a very dramatic race to the finish in Heroes versus Villains where Jerry beat Russell at the mm-hmm. House of Cards challenge. She was able to get her tower higher than his. And the reason she won was simply because she took more cards with her to the upper level. She had to climb up on some scaffolding to reach the highest part. Russell's tower was strong, but the cards that he needed were down at the ground level. So they were racing to the finish, and Jerry brought more cards with her. So to this fictional survivor who's going out there, card management, take all the cards you need with you up to the top of the scaffolding. You'll beat Russell.
Okay. And that pie should be the vertically. Like, are you better off to lay your cards, you know, horizontal and put the piece on top, or are you better off to have it vertically stacked and then have the piece on top?
So based on my watching some of these challenges, the two vertical pieces have the longest end of them lying flat. So it's the shortest version. The vertical cards are down short.
So you say put your cards horizontally and then put the piece on top of them as opposed to putting them vertically with a piece on top.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what Ozzy did. And in most instances, when it comes to challenges, you want to be like Ozzy.
Okay. So go for the stability rather than the added height that would come from laying it vertically.
Yeah. Because if you're more stable all the way along, then you're going to reach that height that you need.
Got it.
Yeah. That's what it seems to me.
Okay. Last run as a Redemption Island challenge during Blood versus Water.
Sounds about right.
Yes, where Caleb was eliminated during that challenge the last time it was run.
Was he playing against Tina?
Tina and Laura.
And so I think that was an instance where you had to either reach a certain height or just have the tallest one when time ran out.
If I recall, I believe Laura Moret reached the goal, and then it was between Tina and Caleb in terms of the time running out.
Yeah, because the way I remember it is that Caleb's tower collapsed, and Tina was like, well, with the time that's left, he's not going to overtake
me. She just like took a knee. Like,
I'm
going to
stop
out the clock.
Building. Yeah, right. She took a kneel.
Yeah, she just took a kneel. Took a wombat.
She took a... No, that's his brother. It's, okay. I don't know. It's confusing because there's twins. Even though Wombat's not one of the twins. Now, you mentioned dominoes. We've seen a number of domino challenges. And Survivor Korong had my first new favorite challenge in kind of a while. This was a domino challenge that was built on a wobbly frame.
Mm-hmm.
You had to step in between this lattice and place the dominoes on the horizontal part. And there had to be a domino rally from one end all the way to the other.
Yes.
I thought this challenge was super cool.
This was the Julia immunity, right?
It was the one that Aubrey really did not want Julia to win, and Julia did win. And it had lots of come from behind. There were a ton of people who started their domino rally, and it wasn't good enough. And Julia actually won it on her second push. She had enough time after her first failed push to go and reset and win it that way.
Yes. The best part of this challenge for me was the shot that they got, the tracking, like dolly shot of Julia knocking her dominoes down. Really, I have to commend the production team on that.
Wasn't that beautiful?
It was fantastic.
And this was a challenge that Scott Pollard, with his giant body, had basically zero chance at winning.
Probably not, yeah.
This seemed like an all-star challenge to me, and it seems like one that we are likely to see again.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a proposed hack. This is what I was thinking while I was watching it. And we've already discussed that my notions on how Julia and Michelle should win challenges are not always on the money.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what it seemed like to me. All the contestants did it the same way, which is they took their dominoes from the starting platform, they entered their latticework, and they placed them in position on the horizontal bar. The problem with that is that then by the time you get to the end, you're kind of married to the spacing that you did at the beginning. At the beginning, you're kind of guesstimating how those dominoes should go. So my proposed hack to this challenge is carry your dominoes over into the lattice and just set them down. Don't worry about putting them in the correct position. Just get them there. It's kind of like taking your starting table with you over to the lattice.
This is that sort of Penner idea of dig up the puzzle pieces first.
Yes.
Yes.
Then start at the end. Like once you've got all your pieces there, you can start at the end because most of them ran out of space before they got to the end and then had to respace them.
Yes.
I think if you can quickly get all your dominoes where they have to be, then you can start with a better guesstimate of how much space has to be between them.
Mm-hmm. They've also done versions of this first in Gabon where Kenny won immunity and then it was on Redemption Island not once but twice. We saw this where Candace and Marissa ended up, did they knock Rachel out at Redemption Island with this challenge? And then also, famously, this is where Russell Hance was eliminated back in the original Redemption Island by the aforementioned Matt Elrod / Wyatt Nash.
Wyatt Slash. This is our Wyatt Slash fiction.
Yes.
Who could have known that we'd talk about Matt Elrod so much? I guess when we're discussing classic challenges.
Well, he did about, 10 different challenges in one season on Redemption Island. So, yeah, a lot of them ended up getting used by him.
Yeah. So they had the... they had the domino acumen. It's, it comes down to spacing. The earlier versions of them had tripwires and they had the dominoes going up and down.
But this one, you're saying it was like on a spring-loaded type thing?
It was wobbly back and forth. And one of the things that was fun about that challenge was not only could you cause your structure to wobble by stepping into it, the very act of the dominoes falling over caused the structure to wobble. So it was like even a success condition worked against you. It was very, very tricky.
Yeah, But it was a fun challenge.
Fun challenge. Beautiful set piece.
And always fun when the person that everybody says, okay, we just don't want this person to win immunity, and then that's the person who does win.
That's the most dynamic. It's the opposite of the coconut shop situation.
Usually creates a fun last 10 minutes of the show.
Yeah, as people scramble. And that's really what we're always trying to do. You know, that's not really in our control. But if the challenges are fair and anybody can win, then that person who's in the underdog position can upset the whole dynamic.
Yeah, that was a really good episode because it was an exciting challenge. That was when we did the know-it-alls this past season in New York. So I remember just watching 300 people watching that challenge play out. Yeah, very exciting.
Very exciting. And we lost Debbie that episode,
yes,
I believe.
Yeah, yes.
That was the price that we paid for a great challenge and a fun episode.
What are you going to do?
Well, let's hope we get her back someday.
Okay. Maybe one day.
We can keep our fingers crossed.
Yes.
And speaking of our hands, I got more challenges to talk about, Rob.
Yes.
We're making a dent in my stack of index cards.
Okay.
You let me know when you're ready to bail out. There's no amount of micro-nutia that I won't talk about. So the Idle Hands Challenge.
Yes.
This is one that we first saw in Philippines. It came back in Cagayan. Two contestants enter the arena. You're holding a small platform with an idol balanced on it.
Yes.
And the first person whose idol hits the dirt is the loser.
Okay. So this is the version where it's two teams and you have to sort of like a waiter tray on a stick in one hand. And then you have to make sure that your little knick-knack doesn't hit the ground.
Yes.
Yes.
Your Nick Mariano knack.
Yes, that's right.
So we saw emergent gameplay in the Philippines the first time this game was played. And I think it was actually Mike Scoopin.
You're too late, Larry.
Yeah. He wasn't too late, Larry, in this particular instance. He's had some other setbacks.
Yes.
So I hear on the news.
Yes. When he's making the news.
You want to watch the news today? Or you want to be on the news?
You'd be on the news. Yes.
So he had the first notion to throw his idol up in the air and then lunge at his opponent.
Mm-hmm.
The version of emergent strategy that we haven't seen is that if Mike throws his idol up in the air and comes at you, maybe you throw your idol up in the air, and since his went up first, in theory, it should come down first.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's kind of like a mutually assured destruction aspect to it.
Oh, that's interesting. So at the point, now the move here is that he's sort of like going all in. This is going back to that challenge, the first thing we talked about where, you're going to go around in the hot pursuit. He's going to go all in and try to knock your thing over. At the point where he is throwing his thing up in the air, I mean, if you have all of your faculties, you just need to just do nothing, really.
All you have to do is step away, and you've got gravity working on your side.
Yes.
But so far, most of the people, and I believe Malcolm used this strategy as well, most of the people who go all in, as you say, and huck their idol up in the air, then they are free. They no longer have to worry about balancing anything, and they can just jump at their opponent.
Yes.
We haven't seen anybody try the sort of defensive counterpoint to that.
I know they did this back in the Philippines, as we mentioned. I believe it also comes up in Cagayan.
Yeah, there was a great matchup between Wu and Spencer in this game.
Yes.
And Tony and Morgan, which was sort of an odd match there.
Yes. Don't look at our eyes.
Not a problem.
Yes. 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 Have they done it another time since then?
Just those two.
Just those two. Okay. Yeah. So we'll see if it comes back in the next year.
I will say, and I know it's not seemly to read your own reviews. This was a challenge that I contributed in the room.
Oh.
I walked into Costco one day. And, when you first walk in, there's all those big screen TVs.
Yes.
And they were tuned in. It was a feature. It was like Survivor, classic challenges. And they showed Cagayan playing Idle Hands.
Yes.
And I was like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
A wall full of giant TVs at Costco displaying.
What was the pitch on that?
Kerhofer is kind of the king of pitches. He's like the P.T. Barnum in the room. He's always got a lot of dynamism and physicality and, he makes a real show of it. And so I've kind of like learned at his knee, not his kneel.
Yes.
Or
wombat.
So the way I pitched it was, okay, everybody stand up because it was post lunch and, we were all kind of in like food coma. That's usually how it goes in the room. The worst time to pitch is either right before or right after.
And you were
lunch.
All holding your lunch tray
because it was right after lunch. I was like, no, an idea can come from anywhere.
Yeah.
And I said, everybody stand up. In one hand, imagine you're holding an ice cream cone. And, do it so everybody, physicalizes it. So we all hold this imaginary ice cream cone. I said, now, put an imaginary tennis ball on your ice cream cone.
Okay.
The last person whose tennis ball hits the ground is the winner.
Okay.
And then I went and smacked the arm of the guy standing next to me to show, like, this is how the game is supposed to be played.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little, you know, kind of like we were talking about with the Bob Harris book, just trying to make it, like, visceral, you know, making the pitch something that you can see and imagine right away. And it's like, oh, well, so what, is it an endurance challenge? Oh, it's a physical challenge because he just hit that guy and that causes his tennis ball to hit the ground. That was the pitch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it wasn't when you were talking to Wombat Gottlieb, but he was holding an ice cream cone and then you knocked it out of his hand and said, see, how does that take?
Yeah, you like that?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't do that. That's a very mean thing to do.
Knock somebody's ice cream out, sure.
So the great, you know, a couple of the patrons had some good questions that I don't really have a good answer for. You know, the great, you know, Drew Bingham asked about the optimal strategy for sumo at sea.
Yes.
This is a challenge we've seen again and again.
Mm-hmm. Different variations, sure.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a challenge other than just be, like, physically stronger than the other person.
Yeah, I think you want to try to keep a low center of gravity, but other than that, there's really not much you can do in terms of being the smaller person. I mean, I guess you could try to do some sort of, like, Olay type move where...
Olay!
Yeah, I think you could just sort of, like, be towards the edge, and then as the person, like, comes and tries to dive bomb you, just sort of, like, drop to the ground, and maybe you can, like, get them to fall over and get them... But I
like
just
Lucy in the football with Charlie Brown?
Yeah, I don't really think that there's a lot of stuff you can do if you're physically outgunned.
We were just talking about Randy Bailey and how clever he was in the blindfold soccer game. He hacked that challenge. Randy
yes.
went up against James at
yes.
sumo and C.
Well, I do think that that was at least an attempt at a hack there of, okay, that we know that that is their most physically imposing person there. Let's throw our weakest person, or at least our person who is willing to be sort of like the lamb to the slaughter,
yeah.
against their strongest person and make them waste their best player. And then maybe we can get sort of an advantage in then having now our best player against their second best player to sort of like, you know, just find the matchups that you could win. It did not work for the villains. I believe they got shut out that day.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that, but they did. They kind of forced them to, yeah, just as you said, like, waste the James ticket.
Waste James. Unfortunately, in all the other matchups, they were not able to be triumphant. I mean, the heroes were, you know, talk about, like, you know, we're good, but maybe not master strategist, but strong.
It was just about the only thing that the heroes could win.
Yes. One of the few challenges in the early going that they were able to get a win over the villains.
So Shoulder the Load is a physical game where strategy comes into play. We first saw this in Australia where it was Colby versus Scoopin.
Right.
We had Mad Dog promising to take good care of the cowboy after it was over.
This is the challenge where somebody has basically like a pool cue across their shoulders, and then you are loading them up with either buckets of water or sandbags on a string.
Yes, and much like the pool cue in Dark Knight, Scoopin's broke.
Yes.
And right before he fell in the water, he said, "We're having tryouts."
Yes.
No, that's I'm mixing up two things in my mind.
Yes.
In subsequent iterations of the game, strategy comes into play because you'll have three people shouldering the load, and the opposing tribe gets to dictate who holds the weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually they pile on to whoever the strongest dude is, your Rupert or your Austin with an O. And so this game is usually won by a woman, one of the other contestants, you know, rather than the strongest male on the team usually is out because they pile so much weight on him. And usually it then comes down to kind of endurance between the women who are left in the game.
Well, this is a good question because you have challenges like this. You also have challenges where we have sort of like the basketball hoop with a net that you're filling up with coconuts where you have a couple people. Are you better off sort of like just completely overwhelming one person, or is it better to sort of like have an even approach of just trying to take everybody else out? Like, are you better to blitz one person and then just move on down the line, or are you better to have some sort of like systematic even approach to tire everybody out?
Yes, and in both of these instances, the weight is finite. You don't have an infinite amount of coconuts, and the sandbags that you place on the other person's horizontal pole, their yoke, to once again quote Jonathan Penner,
yoke.
the yoke was on you. Once that sandbag snaps, or once that person is out of the game, those sandbags are out of the game as well. So, you know, most of the tribes that have done well at this, you know, they kind of distribute, they put some weight on everybody at the beginning and then pile up on whoever they believe the strongest player is. But yeah, what do you think in terms of, is it better to focus in on the person whom you believe to be the strongest and try to take them out? Or do you take a risk and distribute it a little bit more and hope that they're just going to wear out?
From what I've seen, and again, maybe the evidence doesn't support this, I think you're better off to go ahead and just kill one person, kill the next person, kill the next person. Because that the person who is, you know, hanging in there, okay, I don't have that much weight on me now, eventually when you just overwhelm them, they will go out, as opposed to sort of like evenly distributing it. It's sort of like the frog in the pot of boiling water approach of eventually, like, that pot is going to be hot enough, but, you know, they're not going to realize as much, whereas if you just sort of like shock the system, you know, and blitz each person or each sort of net, I think that they will go out quicker.
And once all the sandbags are in play, then it just comes down to who can hold on to it for the longest. I think, if I remember correctly, in Token Chains, it was like a showdown between Taj and Debbie.
Right.
They all the sandbags had been placed, and there was nothing they could do but wait for one of them to get tired of holding the 100 pounds or whatever.
I think it's a little bit of sort of like an Art of War type thing, where you want to focus all of your forces on one thing and just that attack that one point, as opposed to spread everything out and just be attacking everything all at once.
Yeah, it's a tactic some people apply to eliminating their debt, right? If you have multiple debts,
right.
You line them up from smallest to biggest and try to kill the small ones first.
I believe they call that a waterfall.
That sounds pleasurable.
Or snowball, the waterfall, avalanche.
Very different climates.
Yeah, yes.
It's like we're playing pyramid.
All different things, yeah. But yeah, that same sort of idea where if you have, you know, like 10 credit cards, just, you know, make the minimum payment on a bunch of them and then put everything you can on knocking that one out and then just go down the line instead of trying to, you know, be overwhelmed with trying to pay everything.
It seems to be the tactic that works for a lot of tribes. And just as we were talking about, you don't want to be the person who goes with a kooky, out-of-the-box strategy. Like, for instance, if you wanted to put all the weight onto everybody equally, you know, over... like with each round, just go down the line. Meanwhile, the other tribe is piling up on your strongest person. It could be, it's a risk.
Yeah. I think that you just want to have a clearly defined plan of this is what we're doing and then just keep moving along with that.
In the interest of coaching a potential future survivor, the word scramble challenge. A lot of times when you're playing along at home, they didn't used to do this. They'll reveal to you the answer to the word scramble while Jeff is explaining the challenge.
Right.
Sometimes it's kind of fun to play no looksies. Like if you shut your eyes during that time, then you can kind of guess what the challenge is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
These are word scramble challenges. They're a little less challenging than the kind we get when we're hanging out at the National Puzzlers League.
Yes.
But based on the enumeration, they always give you, you know, the number of letters in the words. In many instances, you should be able to have a pretty good guess as to what the answer is going to be based on how many words there are and, you know, are there short letters in there. We remember the reward with all the fixins challenge.
Yes.
That took a really long time for the survivors to tumble to.
Yes.
I think a strategy that we heard, like, I think Carolyn focused on, but like Dan, you know, didn't heed, was, you know, you want to focus on the X, the weird letter, you know, what word could that go into?
Apostrophe.
You had the apostrophe after the N, and that's not normal.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to zero in on those things.
Yeah.
It's
like basic Wheel of Fortune.
Basic Wheel of Fortune. But again, I think you've been in the game for so long, your, you know, mental ability is probably not
at its highest. Capacity's diminished, right.
Capacity's diminished.
Yeah.
And then the last thing that I wanted to discuss with you here in my pile of index cards here, this was a suggestion from David Baltazar in the Patreon group. In the first immunity challenge of Survivor Worlds Apart, they had the option to go with the 5-piece puzzle, the 10-piece puzzle, or the 50-piece puzzle.
Yes.
How should a future survivor consider such a dilemma?
Well, I think that the problem with the 50-piece puzzle was that it wasn't quite as easy as advertised, as demonstrated by, you know, Shireen really having an issue with being able to solve it. So, like, the 50-piece puzzle should have just been, like, sort of just, like, put the numbers 1 to 50 together.
And in their post-game interviews, I believe both Max and Shireen, I think they were attempting to hack this game and think one step ahead. They presumed that it would be the numbers from 1 to 50.
Right.
And,
like, we've seen that as a puzzle before in Survivor Redemption Island. I believe that was, like, the puzzle that Boston Rob had to do in one of the final immunity challenges was, like, here's 100 numbers. Just play them out.
And what you just said is kind of the fatal flaw in Max and Shireen's thinking, because if you just think about how the board looks, It was 100 numbered tiles. And actually, I know some people thought that that challenge was overly simplistic. I kind of liked it because it was like watching a progress bar fill up. Mm. Like you had a real clear picture on who was doing better than the other. I mean, it wasn't.
You're talking about the Redemption Island version?
The Redemption Island version where the numbers went from 1 to 100. Yeah. It wasn't challenging. You just had to stay focused. Mm-hmm. And you could see, you know, who was ahead as the numbers were ticking up. That's why I say it was kind of like a progress bar.
Yeah.
But 100, of course, is a square number and it's 10 by 10. Both Max and Shireen said that they thought it was going to be that, but a 5 by 10 is not the kind of thing that they've done before. So mm-hmm. if it had been 5, 10, or 100, I think they would have been on solid ground, assuming that it was just the numbers from 1 to 100. But kind of the fatal flaw in the reasoning was that a 50 isn't going to look the same in the box as the 100.
I mean, do you have a thought on this in terms of what you would select, 5, 10, or 50?
The optimal strategy is to do the 5-piece puzzle after having memorized it earlier.
Yes, yes. if you can get the heads up on that.
Yeah. You just put a piece of tracing paper over your TV.
Yes.
No, it seemed like everybody who went with the 10-piece puzzle...
Follow Colin Stone on Twitter.
Always. Yes. Do what Colin Stone suggests.
Yes.
It seems like every tribe went for the 10-piece puzzle, and that was the kind of like fire puzzle or tree puzzle that we've seen before. It was the only one of the three of them that followed what we think of as a puzzle of like spatial pieces that interlock with each other. And it was the only one of the three that got exponentially easier with each piece that you placed. Mm-hmm. You know, that puzzle, it's kind of like the puzzle with rotating central pieces
right.
that we've seen before. Sometimes it's a fish or sometimes it's skulls. Each piece that you place makes the rest of it easier.
Right.
Yeah. It's not like a slide puzzle where you can have almost everything correct, but actually still be really far from getting it.
Mm-hmm.
That puzzle that looks like a fire, looks like a tree, each piece that you place makes the subsequent pieces easier to place.
Yeah. I think that once you've seen that done before, and maybe I'm being overconfident. I feel like if that was in front of me, I feel like that, okay, I know what that's supposed to look like. I've seen the picture on the outside of the box. I feel like I would be able to do that relatively quickly. Maybe the people, and I believe it first comes up, I think, in Survivor Karamoan when Cochran has to do it in that final immunity challenge. I'm sure it was probably most difficult for him. But I feel like that it's very similar to we've seen what that puzzle's supposed to look like a few times now.
In a world of perfect information, because you remember the 5 and the 10 and the 50 were all in bags and you couldn't see what they were.
Mm-hmm.
In a world of perfect information, yeah, somebody who has seen the show before, because I think actually that puzzle debuted in One World, I think.
Maybe.
We'd probably go for that because it does most closely resemble a puzzle as we think of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the 50-piece puzzle, yeah, they're like the edges of the pieces, you know, they didn't connect with each other. You had to kind of intuit what the pattern was going to be.
Yeah.
And the 5-piece puzzle, that's a tricky tangrams puzzle where if you haven't rehearsed it ahead of time, it is really tough. So yeah, I think now what about the strategy I remember some people talked about when that episode aired of once you had a puzzle, you could go back and get the other ones. And in fact, some people did, you know, they tried one of them and went and got the other one. Perhaps the strategy of, and the only penalty was the time that it took to climb the ladder and untie that puzzle.
So you think the move is sort of like do whatever you think. And then after 3 minutes or whatever, or a minute, like, okay, this is no good.
Well, it's a kind of a prisoner's dilemma situation. If you just retrieve all three bags and then you have perfect information and you know what's inside, I don't think you were allowed to retrieve all three bags at once. I think you had to untie a bag, bring it to the solving station, open it up and see what was inside. But kind of like the bad strategy that I suggested before where Michelle swims out to the platform and then immediately goes to the shore.
Okay.
If you bring your three puzzles to the platform one at a time, look inside and determine which one you can solve.
Pass. And then, okay, go back and get the next one.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah. And that's, you're allowed to do that? You weren't locked in?
No, remember it happened. There were two tribes in Worlds Apart who the puzzle that they solved was the second one that they took off the overhead.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, interesting to see if people end up doing that. And again, I think that there's... that the idea of just like looking indecisive, I think it's, you know, this mm-hmm. comes up more on The Amazing Race where a team goes to one end of the detour and then sometimes teams very quickly say, oh no, this is much harder than we thought, and they go to the other detour. Then there's other teams that spend a lot of time on that detour and it's like, oh, what do you want to do? What do you want? I don't care. What do you want to do? Neither one wants to sort of own the decision of, no, let's get out of here. Let's go to the other detour. And, you know, it can really end up, you know, saving some teams or also killing some teams.
There's a pitfall pitfall that is called confusing motion with progress, right? There may be an instance where you're not making a lot, you're not moving a lot. You may be making progress, but what you feel like is, ah, what we ought to do is just go, 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 right? Like a bias for action.
Right.
And in many instances, the actual, you know, the, it's like the tortoise and the hare.
Yeah, and I think it also comes down to, you know, sunk costs, you know, of time in these challenges as well, of like, okay, we've already spent so much time on doing it this way, we can't stop now. So, interesting. All sorts of different things that come up in the challenges that, you know, are sort of like, even on like the first viewing of the challenge, maybe we sort of miss it, but sort of like in taking a look at a challenge, how it's been done over the years, and like the evolution of certain challenges, all interesting stuff.
Yeah, and there's almost like this chess game between production and the contestants. If they come up with a hack that's fair within the rules of the game and it makes for interesting TV, that person gets to be a hero. Then, you know, in a future iteration, they're not going to make it against the rules. But if it's something that seems to be, you know, game breaking, then production can say, oh, by the way, this thing, yeah, you're not allowed to do that anymore.
Any other thoughts on challenges as they stand as we, you know, have finished now 32 seasons of Survivor, heading into, you know, a new spring, fall and spring seasons of the show, in terms of like your opinions on challenges?
I still get excited watching these contestants who are so motivated, and many of them have a great athletic background, and many of them are, you know, so bright. I love watching them pitted against these varieties of challenges. As a viewer, I get excited when I see something new, like the domino game that we saw in Koh Rong, or the version of the navigate the balls to the center of the maze that was played on the water in Koh Rong, where the people had to walk around the exterior of the maze to direct it. That stuff is very, very thrilling for me, not just insofar as it exists as a self-contained competition, but also what is revealed about the character's strength, or, you know, humorous or dramatic things that come out of those challenges. It's still very thrilling for me.
Okay. Well, always very thrilling for me to have you come through here and talk about basically anything, but especially on your forte and talking about these challenges.
Can I throw a trivia question at you? This is something that I stumbled upon.
Sure.
In a conversation I was having with my wife about Dr. Pulaski.
Okay.
From Star Trek Next Generation.
Yes. Yeah.
In terms of second TV doctors.
Yes.
Okay. The great Sean Kenneth.
Yes.
Survivor's first doctor.
Yes.
Who was Survivor's second doctor?
Okay. That is a real leap to go from the season two doctor from Star Trek The Next Generation. that for whatever reason, Dr. Crusher was nowhere to be found in season two, and very happy to have her back in season three of Star Trek The Next Generation. All right. Would you say, now this is, again, this is like now, like really we're crossing the streams to the Seinfeld podcast. Is Carl the dentist a doctor?
I want MD after their name.
Okay.
Carl has DDS. And I don't want RN, so I'm not going to accept nurses.
Okay, so then again, you have John in Marquesas. I'm trying to think if there's a doctor in Thailand. There's nobody that I could think of off the top of my head. In the Amazon, I don't believe we have a doctor. And in the Pearl Islands, I don't think that there is a doctor there. I'm guessing it must be a while. And is Margaret in Guatemala? She's a nurse, not a doctor. I don't believe that there's a doctor in Exile Island or Cook Islands. One that I can think of. Boy, is it Marcus? Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I guess doctors, they do pretty well, so maybe a lot of them don't want to go and play Survivor. But we were talking about second TV doctors, Dr. Capra from Northern Exposure, Dr. Pulaski from Star Trek. And so from, you know, as a Survivor trivia nerd, who was Survivor's second doctor? I couldn't believe that it took all the way to Gabon for our second Survivor doctor.
I think that Dr. Sean just set the bar so high. Yeah, and it was really, that was it. You have in Big Brother, Dr. Will. I wonder if you have another doctor that I'm trying to think of who's the second Big Brother doctor.
Is there a doctor in the house?
I don't know. I don't know. Again, he set the bar so high. So good question.
Just some fun trivia.
Are you a big Star Trek guy?
My wife got me into Next Generation. She grew up watching it. And then I read this blog post by Max Temkin, the creator of Cards Against Humanity, that said, a lot of my friends have not seen Star Trek Next Generation. Here, in my opinion, are the 40 episodes that you should watch in this order.
Yes.
And I said, hey, you know, to my wife, I was like, so this seems like a good way for me to get started. And I loved it. I am all in on Next Generation. Now I want to go back and watch the whole series again, starting from the beginning.
Yeah, you know, I think I may have recently sent that same list to Antonio Mazzaro, that he was looking for, like a watch list of the Next Generation. But yeah, good stuff, good stuff. All right, Miles, thank you so much for coming in. What do you want the hashtag to be? Is it Wombat? Is it Owler? What do you want the hashtag?
Well, let's see. It's probably not going to be Nyatt Wash.
No, not
the
Nyatt
anagram
Wash.
Of Wyatt Nash. I think we had so much fun with Wombat.
A shout out to the great Wombat Gottlieb. Okay. All right. And then, Miles, of course, if people want to talk to you about doing an event with your company, what's the best way for them to check out what you're doing?
You can the great way to check out what I'm doing is my Twitter, which is @MilesNye, and that's spelled MyLesNye. I've got a Y in my name, same as Wyatt Nash. And you can also go to our company's website, which is wiseguysevents.com. There are no Ys in that,
yes,
except for the wise guys.
Yes.
And that's the way you can find out about our great team building games for companies and for events.
All right. Well, good stuff. Very happy to dive into the off-season Survivor podcast. I'm sure it's a nice respite from all of the Big Brothering we're doing this summer. Big Brother 19 is going to be on this fall. Can you believe it?
I really enjoyed your podcast about why Survivor fans should watch Big Brother. That was a great podcast.
There is a little emergent gameplay happening in Big Brother 18.
I didn't take your advice.
Yes.
I didn't start watching Big Brother.
Might have dodged a bullet.
From the chatter I'm hearing, maybe I'll be better off with a genius rewatch.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, plenty of good stuff to come. Our next Survivor off-season podcast, we're going to be talking about doing a deep dive into some of the zero vote finalists in Survivor history and what went wrong. What did go wrong there for those players? We're going to be talking about that next week in the Survivor off-season podcast series. So looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say in the comments, robinsonwebsite.com, and all the best. Take care, everybody.